Hello. Welcome to the Hope Show. 1983. Myself and Michael here are going through 10 songs that we think are worth remembering from 1983. Started off picking five of our favorite songs from each year. It's kind of gone on a little bit more than that than just our favorites, kind of songs that maybe mean something. But again, Michael, you're very welcome.
Thanks very much, Noel. Great to be doing this with you.
No easier.
No, and I thought it would get easier as we went along to find five songs that, you know, meant something or said something about punk or traced the evolution of punk. But there's more than five every year of songs that you think that really says something.
I know. I'm excited about tonight's show. There's probably four of the bands tonight that at the start of this, you know, when we started talking about doing this, you know, taking 1976 into account and going from there, there's at least four bands tonight that I was looking forward to including, like really wanted that they be nearly in my top 10, you know, or certainly close to it anyway. So I'm looking forward to tonight's show.
Great.
And this, starting off, this band were certainly got in that top 10. So this is the first song tonight. It's from Bittersweet from New Model Army. We could do a few shows on New Model Army and our history with them, but go ahead.
Well, to me, this was a revelation because it was completely punk rock to me, but it was also very, very much about emotions, about feelings. It, even though New Model Army had a lot to say about society, about the world, about how we live, they really had, I think, a knack, a brilliant, precise way of looking at the world and documenting the world through very, very human emotions. And, you know, thinking of New Model Army, I always think that their graphics are incredible. They're very, very much part of literally of the package. And, you know, there's Jules again. You look for women who really made a difference to punk history. And to me, Jules is one of those individuals who some people mightn't even know her name, but I think along with Steve Avril, who did all of U2's or pretty much all of U2's graphics, Jules and New Model Army, it's one of those long relationships where a band had someone who could perfectly capture what they were trying to say in their music with the sleeves. I just think they're a remarkable band who've never wavered in their quality. They've certainly evolved. They're a bit more, they were all in your face, but they're a bit more, I don't want to say metal, but a bit more rock in your face. But a band that I've never, ever lost faith in.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's their first release. It's on Quiet Records. I think it was released as a Flexi, but Quiet Records, I think, went on. Red Letter Day is probably the only other band that I'm... They did a few more releases, but Red Letter Day, I'd certainly be aware of. New Model Army from Bradford, from this industrial kind of town in the 80s. Smog-filled town. The name and Slade the Leveller, it's kind of steeped in English history. And it kind of suddenly, you know, to be honest, New Model Army got me more interested in reading about English history than school did, you know, on what was going on. And like, this is the introduction to them. You know, we've seen them so many times. You've seen them more than me, but you know, we went to see them so many times. The TV Club, I think it was January 85. The Tube called them the ugliest band in history. I think Muriel Gray or whatever from the Tube. I was reading about this. But for me, they're one of the friendliest bands, you know, like from that time when they played in the TV Club. And I remember, God, you know, when you think the things you do, it was £5 in. And I wrote to New Model Army and said, that's a ripoff. That's disgraceful that you're charging £5 into a gig. And to think the cheek, you know, so here's Justin Sullivan, our Slade the Leveller, receives this letter from some upstart in Dublin, you know, saying, oh, you shouldn't be charging £5 into your gig. And what he does is he writes back. And he goes, yeah, I understand what you're saying. Sends a big, long letter back. And you're going, wow, this is the respect I had. You know, like looking back, I'm almost embarrassed by the fact that I did write and say that. But, you know, get the letter back, you go meet them in Dublin, interviewed them in Dublin. And they were just like, they were just, you know, classic. Now, Vengeance came out in 84, the year after, and we're talking 83 here. But it's just, it's that kind of energy of being in a band that they approached it all with. Even though there was a mystique to them, a certain mystique, and you mentioned, you know, the artwork, you know, it wasn't like, hey, you know, let's all be friends here. But they were so friendly. And you know, they had all the people going to see them, and it all became one big community at their gigs, didn't it?
Absolutely. And you know, they had that their following. But I was really struck because I thought, God, they must be so happy. They have all these people who go to their gigs. And as I said, they were very friendly, very welcoming. But I remember an interview that really struck something in me where he said, and he must have been asked question like I would have said, you know, isn't it great all these people following you around? He said, well, no, actually it's not, you know, we wish they'd put that energy into forming their own bands or doing something for themselves. And I thought, that's actually a remarkable perspective. So you know, quite an uncompromising band. You don't feel that they ever made an effort to fit in, and that might be part of the secret of their longevity. But a truly remarkable band, maybe not the most definitive punky sounding band, but a band that came out of punk. And
very much
he wrote that beautiful thing about seeing the roots and what the roots meant to them, and how they've tried to kind of embody that feeling of seeing the roots when they played in Bradford. And I think they've really succeeded in keeping that sense of community alive that punk bands meant, represented to me.
Absolutely. We could go on, but I better stop and we better move on, because we've 10 songs to get through tonight. Another band coming very much from community and very much doing their own thing were Bad Brains over in they came from DC, but they kind of relocated to New York. And this is Bad Brains, the Rock for Light album released in 1983. Yes, Bad Brains, just love them. You know, like we're going through punk, we're going through the history. You know, we've had that first sound, that first wave. We've got our post-punk. We've got a kind of menacing sound appearing with some bands in the UK, and New Model Army be part of that. And you have this hardcore scene emerging in the States. Bad Brains, this is one of the bands that I said, we have to get these in, you know, and obviously I'm sure you're not in any disagreement over this. Like they started in 1976 as a jazz fusion band, Mind Power. Punk rock comes along, the Ramones come along with a song called Bad Brain, and then this band appears. It's like, I don't know if they were banned in DC, because there's a whole history of them playing gigs in DC. But they certainly got a song about it. They moved to New York. They become part of the New York hardcore scene that's emerging in New York. And I was reading a great book there recently about the New York scene in the 80s. And there's a fella called Todd Ute. He was in Warzone, Murphy's Law, and Agnostic Front. And I read his quote out, "Bad Brains were our Led Zeppelin and our Beatles." And Todd Ute, like, he went on, he was in Danzig and Sound as well, you know. John Joseph from the Cro-Mags. There'd be no New York scene without Bad Brains. Just incredible band. And their live shows seem to be so intense. That album, I got that album in 83 when it came out. And I was just completely blown away. And I sang along. No idea what the lyrics were. I was just singing along to the sounds that were coming. It wasn't, you know, a band in DC. It was just whatever the noise was, I was singing along. And every time I listened to Bad Brains, I don't know. I just get this whole gamut of emotions, and it's like, it's exciting, it's refreshing. They're so powerful, it's aggressive, and it's just a joy to listen to them. And it still is refreshing, you know, 38 years later. What about the Bad Brains for you, Michael?
Well, again, like you, they just swept me away with the ferocity of their sound. But yeah, I also think that they're the perfect band to play for anyone who says, oh, hardcore, that was just noise, and it was fast. But it was fast and it was precise. You know, these bands were technicians,
yeah,
who could, you know, play with ferocity, but also very, very melodic. I think this is extremely melodic music. Yeah. And I didn't get to see them until 1989, until September 1989. I don't think they ever came to Ireland.
No, I don't think so.
First time around. So it was after I'd emigrated. And it was in the Astoria in London, and people just went mad.
Yeah.
Because I think they just whipped you up into a frenzy. And also, yeah, maybe in the States, you'd more chances to see them more frequently. But it just seemed that people who were into hardcore or into great music, whatever you want to call it, in London were just ecstatic. And after, you know, when the band finished their set, I shouldn't be laughing, but people ripped down the curtain, this huge curtain. I think it was a punk rocker from Dublin. Might have been close to the front when this incident allegedly occurred. But it was one of the greatest performances that I've ever witnessed. And that was in 89. I can only imagine what they were like.
Yeah.
You know, when albums like this were just coming out. Yeah. But they just show that hardcore, you know, deserves to be taken very seriously. It's not a margin, I don't think, in rock's history. Yeah. I think it infused it with so much energy.
Yeah.
And a brilliant band. And it's relevant that these were black guys.
Yeah.
Who interspersed their music, you know, the hardcore songs with reggae. Like full on reggae.
Yeah.
Not anything except full on reggae. So I think they really, really, they meant that hardcore wasn't generic angry white guys, if that was the stereotype.
Sure.
Brilliant band, but did you ever get to see them, Noel?
No, I saw HR last year in Rebellion. You know, and it's amazing to see them, but no, only on video and looking on in just amazement at what was going on in the crowd. It's like watching, you know, from back then, there's like a Dead Kennedys video, there's a Minor Threat video, and there's a Bad Brains video. And just everyone on stage, everyone jumping off the stage, and just, it's just bedlam. But just the excitement is just incredible. Just thinking, though, about Bad Brains, and we're going through this kind of the history of punk, would they have been the first punk band to start to have more references to a religion? So Rastafari in their songs, because, you know, then you do have following on from that, especially New York, when we mentioned that, is that Hare Krishna's, you know, come into a bit, this Krishna core. There's some Christian bands, you know, appear later on. I wonder were Bad Brains the first one?
That's a hell of a question. I hadn't thought of that, but just from my limited knowledge, I'd say you're completely right. Yeah. And again, that's another reason why they're so important.
Yeah, yeah. Incredible stuff. Okay, we move on to Germany now. In Germany, isn't it?
Yep.
Yeah. Einster Zande, Neubatten, next song, a song called Tanz Debil.
Stell dich tot. Stell dich tot. Ja. Stell dich tot. Ja.
Wow. Einster Zandai Neubarton. Label mates of Bad Brains. They released a cassette in 1984 on Roar, R-O-I-R, the New York tape label, which I wanted to get that Roar stuff in earlier. Maybe we will at some stage anyway, because that was quite an influential New York tape label. Bad Brains' first album was a cassette on Roar as well. Shared members of the birthday with people from the birthday party or the Bad Seeds as well, who we played last week. What an interesting band.
Yeah, and now historians will probably correct us on this. I have this in 1983, even though this record that we just heard came out in 1981, but it was on a compilation of various bits of music from them from 81 to 83 that didn't get released until 84. But I tried to emigrate in 1983, but it really just turned out into a long holiday. That was great. And I got to see them in the Subterranea Club, where we saw the Clay People later. And it was just one of the most incredible, intense shows that I'd been at that stage of my life. And looking back on it in my 40 plus years of going to gigs, it was almost insane. You'd fire, you'd sound, you'd people with pneumatic drills, you had shrieking. And it was really, really compelling. It wasn't just interesting where you think, God, that's really, really cool and it's different. It was interesting, but it pulled you in to wanting to go and see something that was a little bit dangerous.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say now with health and safety, you'd be doing it over there. And, you know, it was an amazing night for me because down at the back, leaning against the back wall, Nick Cave was standing beside Mark Almond, and, you know, one of the tallest people in rock and one of the shortest. And certainly Mick Jones was there, and I think Joe Strummer was. And, you know, it's a small enough club, and I thought, God, this is great.
Yeah, of course. You know,
every gig you go to in England, Nick Cave and, you know, Mick Jones and Mark Almond must be there. But, of course, I never saw such illustrious people together at a gig. But to me, and maybe again, this isn't prototype punk rock, but I would not have ever come across this if the doors that were opened by punk hadn't allowed someone like me in Dublin to hear Neubatten on John Peel and think, that's extraordinary.
Yeah.
You know, repellent. The first time I heard him, it wasn't. I'd say the Carpenters weren't worried when they heard this. but it was, I think they're a fantastic band, and I got to see them quite a bit later on, and all was thrilling live. And then, you know, obviously Blixit Bargeld goes on to be very prominent in Nick Cave's band. I absolutely loved them. And to me, this just shows that punk opened the door.
Yeah.
And you didn't have to sound punk. And maybe the band's influences might be before punk. But for me, as a listener, this is punk to me because it came through that door.
But isn't it asking questions of both music and it's asking questions of the listener, which certainly... for me, you know, that comes from punk questioning things and that anyone can be in a band. You know, they could well have existed without punk. I don't know. But I think it opens as for ourselves, you know, as music fans at the time, you know, you're opening your ears to all this kind of stuff and you're ready to listen to anything that's kind of coming a bit that's a little bit different. And they certainly were a little bit different anyway. Do you think if you hadn't have seen them, would they have been on your radar as much?
It's a very good question. And maybe not. But I go back to their records and I love the records without, you know, the live experience. So I may not have come across them as quickly, but it would have been a huge loss to my listening pleasure.
They're still going. They're still going, aren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah. Amazing. Amazing. Okay, let's get back over stateside now. After that, this is a band that we played, I think, two shows ago from 1981, but this is 83. This is Minor Threat with Out of Step. Minor Threat, Out of Step. We played, ironically, it was Straight Edge, I think we played a couple of years ago, but a couple of weeks ago, which related to a couple of years back. This was released as a single, and then it became the title track from the Out of Step album. To me, Minor Threat have to be there because they're just game changers. There's something brewing in the States now at the moment with hardcore. And these are game changers. And we did reference it, but like Discord is really kicking on now. It's starting to release records. And it's releasing records. It's trying to chronicle what's going on in DC. But they're also saying to people in DC, you know, you don't need us to release your record. You do it too. We can help you. And that's how there's some of those Discord numbers, like our 10.5 or, you know, 11 or 100.5, you know. And now Discord became the kind of punk rock historians almost for DC and the archivists for DC, but they were trying to encourage people. And they were doing that to people all throughout the States, all throughout the world. And this is coming straight from, you know, punk rock or the Damned or whoever they were listening to, the Cramps, whoever they were influenced by, and getting out, doing their own stuff and telling people, you can do it too. We're out of step with the world. That's okay. Just game changers.
Yeah, and you know, we were talking about Black Flag previously. These bands worked their socks off to tour. Yeah. Like I can't imagine how brutal and the discipline, and you know, DOA I include in this, how tough it was for these bands, but they persevered, and there's so much to love about this band. But what this reminds me of, Niall, is how important singles were. Mm-hmm. Like albums were a big deal. Albums were expensive.
Yeah.
So I probably had more singles than albums, but I put as much time and energy and care into listening to a single as I would have into an album.
Yeah. Yeah.
I just would have played it more, but I was demanding as much from a single, and with bands like this, I was getting so much from a 7-inch. They made me think, and I still feel it, that there's something so honorable with a 7-inch single that's done right.
Yeah. It's hard to believe, isn't it? Because, you know, we're sitting over a computer talking to each other here and playing these songs through a computer. We don't have to get up out of the chair to flip the record over. And even, you know, when you're listening to stuff at home, you know, I'm still listening to records, but I listen to albums. I don't really listen to 7-inches as much because it's like, oh, I have to get up out of my chair. Whereas I would have been excited to get up out of my chair to put on the other side of, you know, some of these 7-inches, that bittersweet single with New Model Army or whatever, you know, you're excited to turn the record. It was. They were just pieces of art, weren't they, at the time?
Yeah, absolutely. And they demand that you listened to the B-side with you know, that you studied it.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't an album track. It was, there's something on the other side of this fabulous song that I may have bought it for. And I'm going to study that as well. Yeah. So I agree with you. I think it's an amazing piece of industrial art.
A
7-inch single.
Yeah. Okay, we'll move on. We go back over to the UK and we'll play Public Image Limited next. This is not a love song.
This is not a love song.
Okay, that's the remastered, the kind of the remixed version of This Is Not a Love Song. Decided to give it the kind of the longer version rather than that, you know, we spoke about the 7-inch earlier on. I think I know why you picked this song, Michael.
Why?
Because Ireland beat it in the charts, beat the UK chart position. Is that it?
Terrific. I don't. Terrific.
Number three in Ireland, number five in the UK.
Fantastic. Top three single. Any country that didn't have that as a top three single didn't know anything about popular music. Funnily enough, the album, This Is What You Want, This Is What You Get, that it's from, does have Bauer on it. So obviously big Irish connection, but this is not a love song, but it is a pop song. Is it a punk song? Maybe scholars would say it's not, but it's Johnny Lydon. So everything he does, to me, we can say, that's punk if he wants it. In fact, he mightn't even want it, but we can say we got to hear that voice. And it's dance music. Now, especially with this remix. These guys were listening to rhythmic music. These guys were steeped in reggae, in soul, in Irish traditional music even. And there was... Lydon's work was never, ever going to sound boring or uniform or straightforward. When you think of the difference between their singles. Punk rock is the sound of innovation. It's the sound of people who lots of people wouldn't have given a chance to. They wouldn't have given an opportunity. They wouldn't have said, hey, young fellow, young lady, you should go into a recording studio with all of that energy. These are people who wouldn't have been allowed to make the tea in recording studios. But here they are, early 80s, making music that's absolutely compelling and to me important.
It is taking punk to the dance floor, you know, but maybe leaving the punk behind, because whether it's a punk song or not, you know, it's open to question. But as you completely are so right in saying, you know, it's John Lydon, so you know it is punk rock. You know, I don't know. I was 15 at the time, and it gave me an excuse to kind of dance. You know, you could get on the dance floor because Public Image Limited, and you could say, oh, yeah, I like that song, you know. Interesting that the lyrics, you know, I'm changing my ways where money applies, might show a direction that Lydon ended up going. But, yeah, it was bringing that onto the dance floor, and in some ways, in a strange way, it was like saying, yeah, we now the punks can be on the dance floor and not just for Alternative Ulster or whatever that mad punk rock song that they can pogo up and down to. Suddenly they're, you know, out on a dance floor dancing to a top three hit in Ireland. Good stuff. All right, we'll move on to next song, back over to the States, back into this hardcore scene that's really emerging in the States, and this hard-working hardcore scene. Up next is Minutemen with Bob Dylan, Rogue Propaganda Songs. The Minutemen, Bob Dylan, Rogue Propaganda Songs. I love the Minutemen. Every song takes you on a journey. It's like you get in the van, you know, and you can imagine it's one of these, you know, open back trucks. You're getting in the truck. Mike Watt or D Boone turns the key, starts driving. You've no idea where he's going. He turns a corner with, you know, after one verse, and you've no idea what's going to happen. And suddenly the car stops, the song ends, and you're going, all right, we're here. Where are we? It's that kind of, that's the sound is just, it's not such an accessible sound, but yet it is. But it's so interesting, you know, because it's not just your verse, chorus. It's gone off and it goes in so many different angles. And there's just something about the Minutemen to me. It's like they're just a working person's band. You know, there's nothing flash about them. They're not rock stars. They just get in the van. They're just a band. And D Boone, the story of D Boone is, we spoke about Malcolm Owen and the Roots. To me, D Boone is just as tragic, you know, and it's such a, you know, what an awful way, you know, to die. And, you know, and it really got to Mike Watt, who's been playing music ever since, but has never, ever forgotten about D Boone and will talk about him at every opportunity. And it was just a shame that the Minutemen, you know, that they had to stop because of, you know, D Boone dying in that car crash. But what a great band. Would the Minutemen have been on your radar back then?
Yeah, definitely. And I'm just thinking, Niall, I love that your show today has got the Minutemen and New Model Army, because both of them, to me, represent kind of small town America and small town England, and kind of the love and the passion and the intensity of everyday life, and as well as the big stuff and the emotions. And it, anyone who thinks that punk rock is 1, 2, 3, 4, we hate the world, they forget, or they haven't come across, just how brilliant these people were at observing life and documenting life. And I think they're remarkable writers. And to me, the Minutemen and Husker Du represented something that was thrilling and didn't sound like punk rock, but to me is absolutely coming from punk rock. And I can't imagine that New Model Army were listening to Minutemen and vice versa. But somehow just hearing them together like this, I think that there's the reason why I love both of these bands is that they brilliant observers of ordinary life.
Yeah.
And they make a sound that reflects the joy and the frustration and the pain of that ordinary life without sounding like they want to be rock stars.
Yeah. Great stuff. Okay, we'll go back to Bradford. So since we spoke New Model Army, if I'm right, I may be wrong. But maybe Southern Death Cult came from that Bradford scene. Anyway, we talk about it afterwards. This is Maya from Southern Death Cult. one of those songs that kind of has that long outro. Is that what they call it? If it's at the end as an outro? That's Maya by Southern Death Cult, which was a split single with, was it Sheriff Fat Man? Tell us, short-lived band, Michael, Southern Death Cult?
Yeah, the single comes out in 82. The album comes out in 83, and the album is kind of bits and pieces. That, you know, they never made a full studio album. But, you know, there's all of this, you know, kind of imagery from Native Americans, from band in Bradford. The drummer Aki then goes on to be to found Fundamental. And Dave Watts was in them and wrote that lovely piece in our book that describes, you know, their particular politics and their outlook and just their power to represent something that doesn't often get represented. But to me, this is absolutely a brilliant piece of pop music. What I can hear and see individuals, bits of Crass. I can certainly see bits of Theater of Hate and hear them. And obviously the guitar player was in common with in those bands. And, you know, this gets called goth rock. But to me, you know, goth is a very, very easy term to bandy around anything that's got crimped hair or you know, looks a particular way. But there was a huge amount of diversity, I think, within that movement. This is a critique of America, and considering where the band go, you know, they shorten the name to Death Cult. Obviously, that's not too catchy. And then they become the Cult and become a huge, huge rock band.
Yeah,
that have loads of influences from the 1960s, from psychedelia. And would Ian Astbury have had the opportunity, and Billy Duffy, to have made that sound if they hadn't come up through the punk ranks? Because I do see this as part of that evolution of punk. You know, we're only 6 years into punk if we're seeing 76, 77 as the date begins. But look at the directions it's going in.
Yeah.
And I think this is a thrilling piece of pop music.
Yeah.
It's a monument.
Yeah. You mentioned, you referenced goth or whatever, and you mentioned it there. It's kind of, that's now starting to emerge, isn't it? You know, that sound is starting to emerge and that look is starting to emerge. But, it, you know, it is coming from punk rock, and it's another new direction that's coming from the punk rock thing. Billy Duffy did a very good podcast with Turned Out of Punk. So it was an interview with Billy Duffy, which was very interesting. Damon Aram from Fucked Up does this podcast, Turned Out of Punk, and he interviews, you know, people who have a background in punk rock. But he did a really good one with Billy Duffy, you know, where Billy Duffy's talking about that gig in Manchester, Manchester Free Trade Hall gig, you know. So it's amazing to think that's where it started for him, you know. And you know, Southern Death Cult, again, it's that menacing sound, isn't it? That kind of, you know, menacing. And they did come from Bradford, ironically enough. Yeah. But I didn't realize that they had such a short career as Southern Death Cult. Obviously, you know, they went on and did other stuff, you know, but just as Southern Death Cult, just a couple of records, wasn't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Monumental. I think they're fantastic band.
Yeah, another band with a short career, and a band that we couldn't get in for 1977. So this single, so we're really cheating with this one. Single was released initially in 77, but an album was brought out in 1983, and this is We Are the One, the Avengers.
We are not Jesus. Christ!
So as I say, we are cheating a little bit, because that was released initially in 1977. But of course, when we were putting 77 together, the Runaways were in there. So, you know, it kind of went the Runaways instead to represent that San Francisco scene. But Steve Jones produced this. So we mentioned John Lydon early on. So it's still the kind of the tentacles from the Pistols. And it was originally on Danger House Records. So it's nice to get them in, you know, as we go through the history of punk rock. And this album came out in 83. It kind of snuck out in 83, really. And it didn't, to me, didn't really get too much recognition. And you can hear that the sound had, like, this was 77 sound of punk in San Francisco. So the sound had evolved in the States to that faster hardcore sound. But, you know, a very important band, and, you know, with Steve Jones producing, Penelope Houston singing. I don't know if it's interesting, but I thought Penelope Houston was Penelope Spheris for a few years. So I thought that, you know, she had produced Wayne's World or Suburbia. But it took me about 15 years to realize that they were different people, because we didn't have an internet, did we? And it was just like, oh God, yeah, wow, punk rock, you know. But yeah, so I just thought it was important for us to recognize the Avengers and what they were doing, and we just snuck it in there. But it's the Steve Jones link, Penelope Houston, San Francisco scene, which was emerging back in 77, which we did speak about, but we didn't get to play the Avengers.
Yeah, I just love her voice. Yeah. I think this is one of the great punk voices. It's one of the great rock voices. And you can still hear that voice and its influence. I think that they're an incredible band. That the power, the ferocity. You know, talk about making a statement. This isn't sitting on the fence. This is a manifesto with a voice that wasn't common. Like that quality, that type of voice. Who else was doing that in 1977? There weren't many, weren't enough female vocalists, and a lot of them tended to be very distinctive, which I think was very, very significant. You know, sometimes the men sounded the same, but it's a fantastic song, and there's absolutely nothing wasted in this. I didn't know about the producer.
Yeah, so Steve Jones.
It's a new one on me.
Yeah. It's interesting. I think, you know, he moved. I read his book. I'm not so sure I'd be recommending people to read it, because, you know, you can guess what Steve Jones was like, but, you know, he does talk about them. And he talks about going over to the States and having whatever sort of life he had for a few years over there. Anyway, so we'll move on. We've two tracks left. We'll go on to next song is the Redskins. This is Lean On Me.
Isolation is an old tale, old tale, thousand times.
Redskins, Michael, Lean On Me. Their second single, I think that was. And we played a single on that label last week, CNT Records, that came out on, and the song we played last week was The Neurotics. Redskins were a very interesting band, you know. They, and I'm sure you'll have a bit to say about them, and I'm delighted that they're in here. They were my introduction to the Socialist Workers Party, which which is interesting for me. And I kind of got interested in Socialist Workers Party for maybe a few weeks. I wouldn't have really been aware of it before the Redskins. And I know someone else who was a member of the Socialist Workers Party purely because of the Redskins. Redskins and McGonagall's were incredible, which was 85. That's the longest song of the night, but I love the brass. It's like the Blades, isn't it? It's that lovely brass sound. But what a cool band, Redskins.
Amazing. And you know, punk music was dance music a lot of the times. It wasn't just making a statement. And you know, like you, if a punk song was played, I wouldn't have danced. I wouldn't have gone to dance floor, but I would have been in places where the purpose of the event was to play music that people would dance for, you know, dance to. But if it's, I couldn't dance to a song that I didn't like.
Yeah.
But I felt that I had to represent my tribe, that anything that was punk or vaguely punk, you had to go out to kind of say to the DJ, look, I'm here. So I appreciate what you've done. But then someone like the Redskins, they pulled you onto the dance floor because it was your tribe. But suddenly you're then surrounded by dance music, because this is drawing from Motown as much as from the Clash. And, you know, that I think the Jam were drawing on Motown. I think that New Model Army are drawn on Motown. And, you know, sure, they don't sound like Motown, but it's in their DNA. And it's just they're playing different instruments. They're coming from different cultural background.
Yeah.
But I think that great punk music can sometimes be great dance to. And the Redskins had so much to say. They were such a force that they didn't hold back. And they also could make your body go with your mind, and like you, the brass, you know, very, very powerful and very evocative of where they're coming from. A short-lived band, like some of the other people we've listened to tonight, but and I don't know that they inspired any particular movement. I don't know if a band, you know, sure, I love Snuff and I can hear brass and kind of punky rock in there, but I don't think there's been another Redskins.
No, but I think they were kind of tailor-made for the time, you know, because just after that, you know, look, politics is heating up in the UK, you know, because Thatcher is in, you know, and then the miners go on strike, and the miners strike, there was a lot of, you know, musicians, and, you know, you mentioned the Jam earlier, Style Council were, you know, were out there, and CNT Records, so there was the Three Johns and the Neurotics, and the Redskins were very much involved in that kind of. Now, they didn't quite support Red Wedge because that was the Labour Party, but they were a band for that year and a half in the UK, when, you know, the year when the miners were on strike, that they were really out there trying to publicise the cause, you know, or what they felt was the cause, and out there and highlight it. But yeah, like you say, maybe from then, there's not too many bands where you go, oh yeah, you know, or you read of bands who go, they're influenced by the Redskins, but they were certainly influential, and they certainly helped raise awareness of so many things at that period.
Yeah, they're definitely important, and I'm delighted that they're in.
Yeah. Okay, so we're on to the last song. Last song tonight is UK Subs. 1983, it's punk rock, so we can't forget about that. And this is UK Subs, another typical city involved in another typical daydream.
It's hard.
again, another song that has that kind of fading out bit at the end. That's UK Subs, another typical city that's involved in another typical daydream. So Michael, this was a 7-inch that I got at the time, and this was my introduction, bizarrely enough, to the UK Subs that I remember. That I'm sure Tomorrow's Girls or whatever, but from my, if I look back now, this was where I started thinking about the UK Subs. I think they'd 7 albums in at this stage, but this was a 7-inch, and I was drawn by the cover of the 7-inch. It almost sounds like New Model Army, you know, the bass line at the start and all.
Yeah.
And it was a funny introduction to the UK Subs, because it's not really what the band are, but I think it's important that we got the UK Subs in, and I've been trying to find an angle down through all the years, and a song, you know, that might be suitable. Because they're hugely important band for us to talk about. I don't know how many albums they've had, 24 record albums or something. It's just incredible output. We go to Rebellion, you see the huge crowds of people there, the huge respect that Charlie Harper has. You know, considering he was an R&B singer before punk rock started, but you know, they're a band that are completely associated with punk. Now, as we go through the years, we got to kind of 79, 80, we started talking about street punk and that kind of sound, that street punk sound that a lot of people would, that you might associate the UK Subs with. But to me, they're way more than that. It's just that the crowd of the people who listen to that music kind of listen to the Subs as well, you know. There's a lot more going on with their songs, and I just love that set. I just wore that 7-inch. We spoke earlier about this, you know, you get up and you have the 7-inch, and like looking through, it was like an animated sleeve, and you're just looking through it, just staring at it for, you know, what probably was hours, you know, trying to look and see what's on the picture. What's that mean, or what's going on there, while listening to the song again and again. And it just brings back those memories of 83 for me, that song does.
It's not Stranglehold.
No.
It's not Warhead. You know, not those tough, dirge-like, you know, I hear bits of The Mob, you know, that came later in those tough songs that would be more typical, maybe, of UK Subs. But this, to me, is a great single because it doesn't sound like those. It's a real step, and I think I hear New Model Army, of the early New Model Army in there as well. I hear a little bit of Jello Biafra in the vocals. Yeah. You know, this is a band that are stretching their wings, that are, could they have known, Niall, that they'd be around for another 40 years when they were doing this?
Yeah.
But they were certainly saying, we're not going to be confined by the sound. I think it was on their own label, Scarlet Records.
Scarlet Records.
It was on Fallout as well, which, you know, Fallout had a band that I loved called Action Packed. And, you know, was really important for bringing kind of street sounds when Top of the Pops wasn't looking to the punk landscape at this moment in 1983. They were absolutely trying to reject it and push it out the door. So they unexpected to hear the UK Subs with this song in this year, but delighted to have it in 1983.
Yeah.
What a year.
Yeah. What a great year, yeah. So that's it. That's tonight's collection. 10 songs. We got through it. 1984 next, no doubt. It'll be a lot easier.
84 has got to be easier, no.
The Suede Denim Secret Police.
Yeah, it's got to be easier. It's got to be kind of 2 songs. That's it. Well done.
Yeah, maybe we should save it for next week, but like 1984 being like that George Orwell book and suddenly the world was going to end. It's funny looking back on it. All right, Michael. I think we'll call it night at that.
Thanks a million, Noel, for the chat. This has been great.
Oh, it's fantastic. Yeah, thanks very much. Thanks very much for picking those 5 songs. We 5 each. We'll go for it again next week. And thanks to everybody for listening. This has been The Hope Show. And we'll talk to you next week.